Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. Now, Trump and tariffs, tech, topsy-turvy politics in Wisconsin. Here's President Trump last Thursday at the groundbreaking ceremony for the Foxconn plant. That's the Taiwanese company that's building a tech assembly plant in Mount Pleasant, Wisconsin.
So I'm thrilled to be here in the Badger State with the hardworking men and women of Foxconn working with you. Moments ago, we broke ground on a plant that will provide jobs for much more than 13,000 Wisconsin workers. Really something.
President Trump believes Foxconn is Exhibit A in his American manufacturing renaissance, but he isn't saying much about Harley-Davidson's decision to move a manufacturing plant overseas other than to threaten them via Twitter with higher taxes. The motorcycle company announced last week that they'll avoid some of the president's higher tariffs by opening production facilities in Europe or Asia. In the midst of all of this, Republican Governor Scott Walker is trying to get reelected, aware that the president he appeared with barely won Wisconsin in 2016. And Walker knows that the taxpayer money that's going into the Foxconn plant is controversial. So we're going to dig into the Badger State's economic politics, and I'd like to hear from you. If you live in, work in, run a business in Wisconsin, how are you viewing the financial commitment to Foxconn and this apparent decision by Harley-Davidson to move a bit of their production overseas? And for everyone, how does Harley-Davidson's decision look to you? Is it economic? Is it politics? Is it both? 651-227-6000-800-242-2828 on Twitter at CarrieNPR. Mark Sommerhauser is with us. He's a reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal, and he's with us today from Madison. Hey, Mark, welcome. Good to have you on the show.
Hey, Carrie. Thank you for having me.
Barry Burden is with us. He's a professor of politics at the University of Wisconsin, Madison, also in Madison today. Barry, welcome to you. It's good to have you on the show.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
Mark, refresh my memory on why this Foxconn deal that they just broke ground on is so controversial. I was looking at that Marquette poll that found that voters are really informed about it, and they're pretty divided on the value of the project. Why?
Yeah, that's right. I think probably the most divisive aspect of it, I would say, is the price tag for the state. The state, in connection with the project, basically to land the project, offered Foxconn an incentive package, mostly of state tax credits, that's worth $3 billion over a 15-year period of time. As much as $3 billion, that number is contingent on how many jobs the project would create. So that amount would only be paid out if the project does create the 13,000 jobs that have been promised. But that number is really what I think has polarized this debate in terms of some people believing that the project will be worth that amount to the state and others having some skepticism about that.
Barry, as I mentioned, there's a lot of knowledge about the ins and outs of this deal, which is complicated. Foxconn's record in other places and what these jobs cost individually to taxpayers. How is it that the people of Wisconsin are into the ground level on this information about the company, and what does that mean politically?
Well, it looks like the public is figuring this out. As you say, it's complicated, and there are a variety of things to think about, including the long time horizon. As Mark mentioned, it's probably a couple of decades out till we know exactly how this has all played out. By that time, the current office holders in Wisconsin are likely all to be out of office. And so voters are trying to figure out sort of what the promises mean in terms of the subsidies that are being provided and the job guarantees that are being provided in response. The Marquette poll suggested that residents of the southeast quadrant of the state, where Foxconn is going to be located, are more positive. They can see sort of immediate job benefits and development happening. The rest of the state, somewhat more skeptical.
call here from John in Springfield, Minnesota. John, you have another facet of this Foxconn deal to raise?
Yes, I wish that you and the guest would address the environmental impact of Foxconn and putting up that plant. As I understand it, many of the federal and state EPA rules have been waived, time periods shortened, and special provisions passed to make sure that this company, which will use 8 million gallons of water a day, is not complying with the rules as we understand them
okay.
now.
Okay. So, Mark, has the environmental part of this also been a reason for some of the skepticism and the whole rest of the state?
I think it's fair to say that that's an issue that absolutely has caused some concern in terms of the state, both water and air environmental permitting requirements that the project has been exempted from. And as your caller mentioned, it is accurate that the manufacturing campus is going to use a really large volume of water from Lake Michigan. Foxconn has talked a lot about the process that they're going to have for ensuring that that doesn't result in any environmental contamination. But, of course, the exemption from some of the permitting requirements has caused some concern.
Barry, is there a sense that Governor Walker, who's well aware of the comparisons economically between Minnesota and Wisconsin lagging in job growth, I mean, is that part of the reason that he is going to have to work hard to justify this taxpayer investment, knowing that, you know, this cloud of you haven't produced the jobs you said you would is following him around on his third go-round on reelection?
Yes, and this has been sort of a pattern with each of Walker's elections. It often comes down to dueling economic statistics and whether the voters of Wisconsin end up believing Walker's pitch in terms of the stats or his Democratic opponent. Walker, I think, will emphasize this fall that unemployment is extremely low. There's a low unemployment rate statewide, and that Foxconn is going to be a major shot in the arm for a part of the state that really needs some additional jobs. He's sort of shifted focus in the last year or so from the creation of a certain number of jobs to trying to create people who are ready to go into those jobs, and so emphasizing workforce development and training. But the Foxconn plant is sure to be a central part of his campaign message this fall. And I think some of the criticisms that might be offered of it, like the concern about environmental protection, are likely to get heightened as we settle on a Democratic nominee to face Walker and that head-to-head competition begins in the fall.
I have a tweet here from Mark who says that the Guardian of London is reporting that Wisconsin will give Foxconn about $5 billion or roughly $350,000 per job created. Mark, that's a little higher than some of the numbers that I saw.
Yeah.
Can we pin it down, or is it difficult to know until the thing is built and they've hired the people they're going to hire?
Yeah, there's been so many numbers thrown around here that it can be difficult to keep track of them all. The $5 billion sounds a little high. There is a number that I've heard that's in the $4-plus billion range that includes a broader range of incentives. The $3 billion figure that I mentioned at the outset is only state incentives, so there are some additional incentives from local governments that you can add to that figure, and if you do so, you get a number that's more in the about $4 billion range. As far as the amount per job, again, there's a lot of ways to calculate that, and part of it just depends on how many jobs are created and how much in tax credits the company collects. I've seen, I know a figure that's more in the about $200,000 per job range.
Okay, well, still a lot, hefty number there.
Yeah.
And Barry, at this point, do people who do not support the project and don't support Walker, do they care whether it's $350,000 or $200,000 per job?
I think the exact price tag probably doesn't matter. It's hard for the average person on the street to get their head around what that means.
Yeah.
What does $3 or $4 or $5 billion in support mean, and what does a certain amount per job mean? I think the concrete manifestations of the project are what voters are going to be looking for. Do we see new jobs being created? Are they well-paying jobs? Do they extend to beyond the southeast part of the state where the plant is located? I think those are the kind of day-to-day things voters will be looking for, and there won't be a lot of evidence of that before the election. So, again, voters are sort of betting on the promises that are being made more than what they'll actually be able to see this year.
Barry, I was looking at some numbers here of approval ratings for the president in Wisconsin. Now, as you know, in other upper Midwest states, he was in North Dakota. He's pretty popular there. He got a big rally in northern Minnesota, although I'll say our numbers are pretty divided here in this state. He won Wisconsin by 23,000 votes. His polling numbers are running about 44% approve and 50% don't. What is that tied to?
Well, Trump did win the state narrowly, as you say, by less than a percentage point, but he earned less than a majority of the vote because there were also third-party and independent candidates on the ballot. So his approval rating is about where his vote share was in 2016. It hasn't gone up much and hasn't dropped much, and he's underwater. His disapproval rating is slightly higher. Walker is doing better than that. His approval rating is just above where his disapproval rating is, so he's at about even. So it creates this complicated dance where the governor and other Republicans in the state would like to take what's good from the Trump movement and build on that and use it to their advantage, but not be tainted by the unpopular parts of Trump's agenda or approach. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a difficult dance for all Republicans around the country. Walker is a really adept politician and might be able to pull it off.
Mark, how do you see the tightrope that Walker has to walk, wanting those Trump voters on his side and probably getting them, right?
For the most part, yeah. I mean, I think a tightrope is probably a good analogy. You know, I covered the U.S. Senate race here in Wisconsin in 2016, and I saw the Senator Ron Johnson, Republican senator, who ultimately was reelected in that race, sort of have to walk that tightrope as well, in terms of, as Professor Burden said, sort of taking those things for which the president is probably more liked and trying to distance from some of the elements that are not as popular. But, yeah, I think it's fair to say that, you know, the vast majority of Trump voters are also going to be Walker voters, although it's probably not a perfect match, but for the most part.
And is Walker so far benefiting from the divisions within the Democratic Party?
I think that's a little bit difficult to say. What we certainly know here in terms of the governor's race here in Wisconsin is it's a very, very crowded Democratic primary. I don't know if you've paid attention to that, but
There's like, what, six or seven? How many?
Eight candidates now.
Okay.
You know, there is, I think, somewhat of a sense that the state superintendent, Tony Evers, is probably the front runner among that group.
Mm-hmm.
But there's, you know, a number of other candidates running really hard in the Democratic primary here that's going to take place in August. So we have a little bit of time before that field will be winnowed down to the point where we know who is going to face Governor Walker in the fall.
Mark Sommerhauser is with us. He's a reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. And Barry Burden is with us. He's a professor and director of the Elections Research Center at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. We're trying to get a handle on some countervailing forces, I guess, some really interesting political push and pull within the state of Wisconsin. President Trump is not as popular as he is in some other states that went for the president during the presidential election. But as both of our guests remind me, the president won Wisconsin by less than a percentage point. And the president has been to Wisconsin recently to talk about the groundbreaking of Foxconn, while he also critiques the decisions that Harley-Davidson has been making about offshoring some of their production. I'm going to ask our guests about that. Wisconsin politics, if you work, you run a business, you live in Wisconsin, tell me how you're seeing the political landscape there. And I'm also interested in how you view, just for everybody who's listening, how you view this decision by Harley-Davidson. Does it look economic to you? Does it look political? Does it look like a mix of both? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter at @KerryMPR. So, Barry, I want your insight on how Harley-Davidson made this decision. They made it very quickly. They made it very public to potentially move some of this production overseas. Do you think it was an attempt to pressure the president into backing down on tariffs, or have they wanted to move production overseas, as the president asserts?
Well, I'm not privy to the internal financials of the company, but it is clear, I think, from the historical record that Harley has threatened to leave the state and leave the U.S. on a number of occasions, and they often get lured back or kept from leaving by incentives, tax breaks, other kinds of offers. Uh-huh. And so this seems to fit with that pattern of threatening to go. I think the offshoring of jobs would not happen for another year and a half or 2 years. So that seems to leave the door open for there to be some negotiations back and forth that might keep the jobs here. It's possible there could be a sort of win-win in this for both President Trump and Harley. If he makes some concessions, he might look like the victor in keeping this important symbolic at least company in the U.S., and Harley would get some financial advantage from it. So I think there's a lot of strategy in it, but there may be some real financial concerns as well.
Yeah. Mark, how do you assess the politics and the economics?
Yeah, and just to play off that, I mean, I think the president's comments sort of suggest, right, that he's anticipating that there may be sort of a back and forth. I think we'll see how that plays out. But I think it's fair to say that the company seems to be anticipating some issues from these tariffs. At least that's been their public statement. I know the president's comments directed towards Harley Davidson have caused a little bit of angst in the business community here in Wisconsin.
Uh-huh.
A conversation I had with the president of the State Chamber of Commerce last week, he really acknowledged that, and I think he was choosing his words really carefully, but, he said he wished the president was not making these comments about Harley Davidson. He was overall pretty bullish on what the president has done for the business community, but he said, the president just needs to understand that Harley Davidson is not doing anything that any other business wouldn't do in this set of circumstances.
Yeah, this is what's interesting to me, Mark and Barry, about even when you talk to Trump voters who work for some of these companies, not only in Wisconsin, but some other companies in the Midwest, you still find a pretty deep-seated loyalty to the president, even though some of the economics of this may backfire on them. Now, that said, it's a really good economy, and nobody's feeling the pinch of this yet. But, Barry, how do you explain that?
It's a little hard to explain. The Marquette poll that we talked about a moment ago shows that the public disapproves of a number of Trump's policies in the economic realm. Tariffs, they're skeptical about. They think open borders and fair trade and NAFTA are all pretty helpful policies, more helpful than harmful. And so there's less support for those policies than there is for Trump himself. I think a lot of the appeal of Trump is his style of taking it to Washington and being aggressive in changing how things are done and kind of speaking to voters in a way that they haven't been spoken to before, more than where he stands on policies. He's slippery on policies and has shifted even on immigration over the last couple of weeks.
Oh, yeah.
So it's bigger than where he stands.
Yeah. So, Mark, it's this overall perception that the president disrupts Washington and speaks truth to power, which makes me laugh because he is the power and there isn't a lot of consistency. But there is this appreciation for that still.
Yeah. I mean, I do think it's important when you're taking a look at the president's supporters to differentiate between the sort of diehard base of support that he has versus other supporters of the president who are mostly Republican-leaning voters who maybe are not quite so wedded to him but are sort of guardedly supporting him.
Yeah.
I mean, we really saw that play out here just throughout the 2016 election cycle in Wisconsin. The president was initially there was a lot of skepticism among Republicans, Republican primary voters here in Wisconsin throughout the 2016 campaign.
I remember that.
Yeah. But we saw some Republicans sort of warm to him. I think some of them still have mixed feelings and are somewhat guarded in their support, but are at least at this point willing to back him.
President tweeted when he got the news about Harley, "A Harley Davidson should never be built in another country. Never. Their employees and customers are already very angry at them. If they move, watch. It will be the beginning of the end. They surrendered. They quit. The aura," which he capitalized, "will be gone, and they will be taxed like never before." A call here from Ray in Orono. Hi, Ray.
Hi.
Hi. How do you see this?
So any business is going to try to diversify away its risk, especially against unpredictable politicians. Trump represents unpredictability personified. So, of course, Harley is well positioned to deal with unpredictability, and they're going to use it to defend their profits and to make their business go. Harley being called an American business is a nice notion. Businesses are global. Mm. They can move wherever they like, and they will move wherever it's most favorable to them.
Yeah.
Otherwise, they will not succeed.
Barry, I think that, I mean, we've seen that, geez, with Medtronic, with a number of Minnesota-based companies. Does Ray pretty much have this right, in your view?
I think he does. What makes Harley a little different is its symbolic value. It's an American company, at least that's how it's perceived by the public, the only motorcycle manufacturer that's really based in the U.S., not Japanese or German. And so there's a sort of emotional attachment to it, or a kind of nationalism wrapped up in that. And Trump has signaled out other companies like this over the past couple of years. Carrier, the American auto companies in Detroit, even though they're international businesses, he really thinks of them as American companies. So I think it has that kind of value. It's not so much that it's actually responsible for lots of American jobs compared to other motorcycle companies.
But your point is really well taken. I mean, he understands the mythology and the symbolism. I mean, he had Harley show up on the, White House lawn a few days after his inauguration, didn't he?
Yeah, and again, that's part of his appeal, I think, which is bigger than his policy positions. Just speaking about the value of America as an institution and putting America first, as he puts it, and making America great again and returning to the days when there were these important American companies that provided jobs and were a point of pride. Harley is one of the remnants of that earlier era, I think, and so trying to hold on to it makes a lot of sense to his supporters.
John called to say, my wife has worked for Harley-Davidson for 20-plus years. They've been wanting to move to Asia for a long time, and this is a convenient excuse. To John in Burnsville. Hi, John, your question for us.
Oh, I'm curious how Wisconsin voters think about creating jobs in Illinois. That plant is actually more convenient to a larger population of Illinois workers than it is to the population of Wisconsin workers.
Might they be hiring from Illinois, Mark?
Yes, I think that's definitely a possibility. I think the location of the plant was chosen to be accessible both to sort of the Milwaukee area, but also certainly to the Chicago area as well. One of the big debates during when the legislature was debating the aid package for Foxconn last year was exactly to this point. What share of workers from this facility are going to be coming up from Illinois and thus not paying all of their taxes here in the state of Wisconsin? I believe that the estimate that was arrived upon ended up being somewhere in the range of 10 to 15% of the workers coming up from Illinois. But we'll just have to see what that actual number ends up being.
Mark Sommerhauser with us from the Wisconsin State Journal. If you've just tuned in, Barry Burden with us from the University of Wisconsin-Madison as we talk about economic politics in the state of Wisconsin. Barry, President Trump was in North Dakota, and there was a lot of discussion about tariffs and what that was going to mean for farmers in the Midwest. And I want you to listen to what the president said specifically to farmers themselves.
Here's what we do. The more they rush, the worse it's going to be. The longer we take, the better. Your farmers, your people are going to be great.
He's saying, be patient. Let this tariffs thing play out, as if he's got some tricks up his sleeve to manage this when there's a lot of anxiety for farmers. How would you describe the state of, I guess, the agricultural industry in Wisconsin, how they are seeing these tariffs?
It's so interesting to watch Trump transition from the business world to the political world. The kind of negotiation he would do with this long view and short view being balanced against one another, I think worked pretty well for him there. In politics, it's somewhat different because you have an audience watching you, or who are the voters, and they may not be as acceptant of the kind of risk he's willing to take. No, I think farmers are genuinely concerned. Soybean producers, corn producers export a lot of their product to Canada, which is nearby. The new steel and aluminum tariffs that are going into effect in Canada today, I think all of those cranberries, other products of Wisconsin, even among Trump's strongest supporters, I think there's disapproval of that particular approach to things.
You know, I thought what you just said about watching him move between the politics and the business is interesting, because there isn't always a coherent strategy. I mean, I don't think you could look at it and say he's consistent in the way he talks to business owners and leveraging his experience as a business owner, and he's consistent in the way he thinks about this politically. It's confusing to try to figure out where the calculation is, which makes me think that there isn't an overall large political strategy here. How do you see it?
I think that's a fair way to characterize it. He is sort of unpredictable in how he responds to things and what decisions he makes, and that's actually worked well for him in the business world because it puts the people he's dealing with on their heels. And again, these are high-risk, high-reward financial transactions, mostly in New York and other properties. But the political environment is somewhat different, and I think that the strategy is working for him in some ways. He made some inroads with North Korea already. Mm-hmm. But the kind of high-level risk is not something you normally see prominent politicians undertaking.
Call here Mark from Cary in St. Paul. Hi, Cary. Your question. Hey, Cary, are you there?
Hi. Yes, I'm here.
Okay.
Isn't it possible that Harley Davidson saw the big financial tax breaks that Foxconn is getting and they said, oh, I want a piece of that too, so I'm going to threaten to leave Wisconsin and then negotiate a better deal?
And Mark Berry told us a few minutes ago that Harley has gotten some pretty sweet incentives by doing that.
I think it's certainly fair to say that every business in the state of Wisconsin saw what happened with Foxconn and I'm sure is having some of its own thoughts about what that means for their business, whether there's a possibility of additional incentives going to other companies. Again, I'm obviously not privy to what the company is thinking internally, but every business, the whole business community is very aware of, the amount of money that the state has put on the table for Foxconn.
I was interested in how you both see this, the results or the consequences of the Supreme Court decision on Janus last week and what it means for unions and how unions are likely to respond to that. Mark?
Sure. I think it may be a little bit of a different situation here in Wisconsin than in some other states, and that's because of the big debate that we had over collective bargaining here in 2011
right.
That resulted in the passage of Act 10, the big collective bargaining law that generated all the protests at our state capitol. And that law had a lot of stuff in it, but one of the provisions in it actually did to public sector unions what the Janus ruling is doing on a national level, which is preventing them from collecting these fair share fees from non-union members. So I guess that's to say that I think the impact here could be a little more muted than in other states, simply because we kind of went through this 7 years ago.
That said, Barry, I mean, unions are really going to have to make the case for their worth. And I would also think that this gives them more urgency around raising money for candidates that are going to support unions, right, at state legislatures, which is where more of these right-to-work laws may be debated. What do you think the effect may be politically from where the unions, how the unions see this decision?
Well, I think in Wisconsin, both this decision and the set of things that have happened over the last 7 or 8 years on the policy side in Wisconsin have really been felt by unions in a dramatic way. Their funds and their membership have both dropped since Act 10 and the other right-to-work kinds of things that have been adopted. And we've seen the amount of money being spent and the number of volunteers on the Democratic side, where unions are most active, has really dropped, and that's worked to the disadvantage of the Democratic Party in Wisconsin. So, as Mark says, I don't think Janus itself will have a large effect, but it's just the latest in a series of things that have sort of picked away the traditional strength of unions in working for Democratic candidates, and that will advantage, I think, Republicans who don't have that to worry about in the same way they would have a few years ago.
You know, that's interesting because the other role that unions can play is getting out the vote. And
yes,
given what's going on with the primary here, ahead of the primary, Democrats are going to need to coalesce fast if they're going to compete against Walker. What does that mean, do you think, for relying on their get out the vote ability?
Yeah, there are sort of two stages to this. One is in the primary. We've got, I guess, eight candidates who are still running and listed on the ballot. And a couple of them are pretty strongly affiliated with unions. And so they will mobilize, I think, those workers in the primary.
Mm-hmm.
And there, union workers matter much more than they do in the general election. In a Democratic primary, they're a sizable share of voters and could really affect the outcome. When it gets to the general election, I think unions end up mattering less. But with elections in Wisconsin are close. It's a competitive state. It was in 2016 when Trump won the state. Walker has already signaled it's going to be a hard-fought election for him, and so the union vote, along with everything else, is likely to matter.
So, Mark, what does all this mean for Tammy Baldwin?
Yeah, I think we're going to see two very close statewide races in Wisconsin in 2018, one of them being the governor's race, Governor Scott Walker trying to be reelected, and the other being Senator Baldwin seeking reelection. I agree with Professor Burden in the sense that I think the union element probably does matter more in a primary situation. Senator Baldwin has a couple of Republicans that are vying for the nomination to go against her, one of them a businessman named Kevin Nicholson, the other one a state senator, Leah Vukmir. And I think certainly now the last Marquette poll that was done did show her with a fairly sizable lead over both of those potential Republican nominees, but that's sort of with the caveat that they're not as well known at a statewide level.
Mm-hmm.
I think the one sort of potentially concerning sign for Senator Baldwin in that poll was that her favorability numbers there were pretty middling, about 41% approval.
Uh-huh.
And that's pretty consistent with what we've seen, is that her approval is about even and significantly below 50% in most of the public polls.
Yeah, it's interesting. So no one on the statewide ballot is overwhelmingly popular at the moment, which I guess just gives us an indication of how divided Wisconsin is, along with so many other states, right?
That's right. I mean, it's just, again, I would really anticipate that both of these races are going to be very, very close. And maybe that means, little things end up mattering a lot more in a race that's divided by a point or two.
I really appreciate the insight. Thanks for letting us benefit from your reporting experience, Mark. Do appreciate it. Hope you'll come back. Yeah. And Barry, same with you. Thanks. I hope you'll come back.
Yeah, glad to be with you.
More conversations about politics coming this week, including tomorrow morning, where abortion stands now with President Trump's ability to make another pick for the U.S. Supreme Court, and what's happening on abortion in state capitals. That's at 9 tomorrow.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828. Or tweet Carrie at KERRI NPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.